Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome back, and nice to see everybody. And okay, we're going to continue on our exegesis and different Mefarshim. I think we're now into France and Provence and Ashkenaz, and let's see where we're going.
Okay.
Dr. Sokolow.
So before French kosher wines became so popular, I would actually have to explain to people where Provence is. But somehow over the last 15 or 20 years, it isn't necessary. Everybody knows you say Provence, and everybody can tell you not only where it's situated geographically, they can tell you which grapes grow there and which wines come from there. In any event, for our purposes, the thing to bear in mind is that Provence straddled not just two different geopolitical entities, but it straddled two cultures and civilizations. To the north of Provence, moving, as I said, into France, was Christian Europe. But moving south across the Pyrenees Mountains into Spain was Islam. So during the 13th century, which is what we're going to look at now, we have three of the most, three of the greatest champions of rational biblical interpretation that ever existed. And I don't think it's a coincidence that they all came from Provence within the span, really, of two or at most three generations. Okay. Now, remember that as I said, because Provence straddles these two cultures and civilizations, they were open to literary and philosophical influences from both. Therefore, it's not at all a coincidence that when the famous controversy over some of the philosophical works of Maimonides erupted in the year 1233, it erupted in Provence. In the French city of Montpellier, which is in Provence. And it was there that the controversy arose. And it's interesting that, at least in the first generation of the controversy, the two sides, pro and anti Maimonides, were championed, as it were, by two outstanding, on each side, an outstanding biblical interpreter. The pro-Maimonists were led by Radak, whom we're just about to meet, and the anti-Maimonists were led by Ramban, whom we may yet get to this evening, and if we don't get to him this evening, we will certainly get to him next week. So we're going to look at Radak, which is the abbreviation for Rabbi David Kimchi, Ralbag, which stands for Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, and Ibn Kaspi, which doesn't have to stand for anything. His name was Yosef Ibn Kaspi. One thing I might point out is that in keeping with their living in Provence, in this rather special culture, a lot of Jews in Provence took as the equivalent of their family names, either the cities from which they came or the professions in which they engaged. Therefore, there's some speculation that the Kimchi family had something to do with either the growing or harvesting or milling of grain, Kemach, okay? The Ibn Kaspi family either made a lot of money, or likelier than that, they came from the city of Argentier. Argent being French for, I don't have to tell the Canadians this, we may have to tell Torontonians, but not, Argent being French for silver. Okay. There was also a family called the Yarchi family. They came from the city of Lunel, Lun being French for the moon. Okay. But I think even Americans know that because they all know Claire de la Lune. They all learned to play that on the piano. Okay. In any event, here we go. So David Kimchi lived from the middle of the 12th century through the first quarter of the 13th century. It was, as I've written, the first of a series of Provençal exegetes, Parshanim, during the 13th and 14th centuries, who rewrote some of the key chapters in the textbooks on Parshanot HaMikra and biblical exegesis. He himself, Rabbi David Kimchi, was the scion of an illustrious father. His father Yosef himself was an accomplished grammarian and Parshan, who had actually tried his hand at one point in translating parts of the Moreh Nevuchim. And he was a younger sibling to an equally illustrious brother, Moshe, whom he frequently quotes in his commentaries. I'll give you an example, difficult really to distinguish the most outstanding examples of this inclination towards rational biblical commentary, but here's one that should work. Towards the beginning of the book of Yehoshua, we have the description of how the people of Israel crossed the Jordan River. And we're told that prior to their crossing, the Kohanim, who were carrying the Ark, the Aron, were instructed to step into the Jordan River on its east bank. The moment they stepped into the river, the waters of the Jordan River, like the waters of the Red Sea before them, parted. And as long as they remained standing there, the waters remained split and the people were able to cross. Once everybody had crossed from east to west, what did the Kohanim do? So here's the question, okay? What would you expect the Kohanim to do? And on the other hand, what does the Agadah say that they actually did? So here's Rashi, who cites, gives us the Midrashic interpretation. And Midrashic interpretation is that the crossing of the Jordan by the Kohanim who were carrying the Aron was unlike the way in which everybody else crossed. Meaning they did not cross. They didn't simply just follow everybody through the Jordan from east to west. Rather, says the Agadah, okay, the Kohanim stepped back onto the dry land on the east bank of the Jordan, okay? Then, Chazru Hamayim La'achoreihem Leilech Kitmol Shilshom, after the Kohanim stepped back onto the east bank of the Jordan, the river resumed its normal course, ostensibly then stranding the Kohanim and the Aron on the east bank, while the rest of the people of Israel had crossed over to the west bank. Says the Agadah, okay, Nasa ha'aron et nosa'av ve'avar, whereupon the Aron, as it were, levitated itself, and it flew across the Jordan River from east to west, not only bearing itself, but carrying aloft the Kohanim who were carrying it. Okay. Radak, right, first restates or rephrases the Agadah, namely that the Ark and the Kohanim, who had initially been at the head of the line of march, because they were the first ones to step into the Jordan, right? Crossed over, okay? And the Pasuk says that they crossed Lifnei Ha'am. Lifnei can mean one of two things. It could mean in front of, literally in the sense, in a situational sense, okay? Here are the people, and they went in front of them. However, says Radak, it could also mean that they crossed Lifnei Ha'am in the sense that everybody was able to observe their crossing. So Radak's simple explanation is that, of course, how did the Kohanim and the Aron get across the Jordan? They followed across the Jordan the way everybody else had gone, and then everybody waited while the Kohanim and the Aron passed them and resumed their position at the head of the line of march. Then Radak tells us, "V'razal pershu b'inyan acher kol ze ha'inyan." he recapitulates basically the Agadic presentation of the story, the one which has the Aron crossing on its own and actually transporting the Kohanim across. And he says, Va'ani tameha mizeh hadarash. He says, I find this homily perplexing. Ma hitzricham lazeh le'ela hapsukim. Why in the world did the rabbis who came up with this homily, what forced them into this explanation? After all, he says, we've been able to provide a perfectly reasonable explanation of our own. The one that said that, namely, after everybody crossed, the Kohanim and the Aron crossed behind them, and then the people waited politely while the Kohanim and the Aron passed them and resumed their position at the head of the line of march. So he asks, rhetorically, he says, Ana ra'u she'aron mitzad zeh v'Yisrael mitzad zeh. Where did they ever get the idea that at some point the Ark and the Israelites were on opposite banks of the Jordan? Uma tzarich laseit aron et nosa'av la'avor. Why in the world would they have to come up with this explanation that somehow the Aron was able to levitate itself and its bearers across the Jordan? And then the passage that I've underlined in the Hebrew text and highlighted in the English text. V'im haya nes kazeh. And if in fact such a thing had happened, which would clearly be miraculous, right? Lo haya hakatuv mifaresh sheha'aron nasa et nosav lamala min hamayim. Wouldn't scripture just simply say so explicitly? After all, the Bible isn't at all reluctant. It isn't reluctant to tell us when miracles occurred. So if in fact this miraculous crossing had taken place, simply, why doesn't it say so? So we see that a characteristic of Radak's presentation of biblical texts is to critique Agadot, to critique rabbinic homilies, the way Ibn Ezra. We saw Ibn Ezra critique them previously, namely to subject them to historical and logical criticism. But Radak goes one step further that Ibn Ezra didn't go. And he says, Afal pichen, right? Mi hitzricham lazeh hanes. Simply reiterating his critique that why couldn't they simply explain it the way he himself explained it? But now he comes up the last two lines. Vehem, however, he says, with respect to the rabbis who produced this homily, Hem she'amru yad'u ma she'amru. Surely, he says, the people who came up with this homily knew what they were talking about. After all, he says, da'atam rechava mida'atenu. Their knowledge was more extensive than our own. You remember that Ibn Ezra ended his critique of the Midrash on the Shittim trees. It's this week's Torah portion, right? Very beginning of this week's parasha lists the things that the Israelites were asked to donate to the construction of the Mishkan, and it mentions the Atzei Shittim, and Rashi raised the question, where did they get Shittim trees in the wilderness? And he cited the Midrash Tanhuma to the effect that Yaakov Avinu had planted them in Egypt, and the Israelites carried them out at Moses' instructions. And then Ibn Ezra says, Lo Yadanu. He finds himself in a methodological quandary. He says, Im Kabbalah hi biyad avotenu shemim Mitzrayim hutziyum. If the opinion that they took these trees out of Egypt is actually a Kabbalah, that is to say, it's an historical fact that was passed along from one generation to the next in an unbroken chain of Ezra, Anachnu Nasur al Mishma'atam, then despite my reservations about it, I will accept it. However, he says, im svarahi, if it is not an historical fact, but it's speculation, yesh levakesh derech acheret, we can seek an alternative, and his alternative is samuch lahar Sinai ya'aratzei shitim, that a grove of shitim trees was there adjacent to Mount Sinai. So notice the difference. Radak is just as critical of this homily as Ibn Ezra was of that, except that whereas Ibn Ezra's bottom line is, what? His bottom line is to dismiss Agadah because it does not stand up to his rational investigation. Radak conducts the same rational investigation, but he feels he has a greater sense of attachment to the tradition. And therefore he concludes with this, I don't know what to call it. I don't know whether it's a rationale or whether it's an apology for the homily, but whether it is the one or the other, that's the way he concludes. We see something very similar in the case of Rabbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, right? Philosopher, Talmudist, mathematician. Here is his commentary on another verse in the book of Yehoshua. Very famous, after Yehoshua won a rather remarkable battle against a coalition of a number of Canaanite kings, right? The day was growing short, and there was much to do to complete the battle. So Joshua, as it were, offered a prayer to God, asking God, literally, it goes, to have the sun stand still. And the verse actually says, Vayidom Hashemesh, the sun stood still, V'yareach Hamad, the moon halted, Ad, how long? Ad yikom goy oyavav, until people of Israel were able to complete their victory over their enemies. And it further goes on and says that this wonderful thing is recorded in a book called Sefer Hayashar. And what is recorded there is Vayamod Hashemesh Bachatzi Hashemayim, that the sun somehow stood still or halted in the middle of the heaven. V'lo atz lavo kiyom tamim, and it didn't set as it customarily did. So, if you read the verse literally and straightforwardly, it would seem that God performed the miracle on behalf of Joshua, and in order to give the Israelites the time that they needed to complete the victory, God basically extended the day beyond its normal 24 hours. And how did he do that? He did that by having the sun stand still in the middle. Here is what Rabbag says. He says that there are many problems with this episode in the book of Yahushua that bear investigation. Ha'echad, first of all, he says, if the sun stopped moving, this would be an immeasurably greater wonder than any of the miracles performed by Moses. Yoter nifla la'en she'ur mehamofetim shena'asu al yedei Moshe. How does he know that? Very simply, he says, let's make a catalog of the miracles that Moses performed. So Moses turned his stick into a snake. And Moses put his hand into his cloak, and when he removed it, his hand was leprous. And Moses turned the Nile into blood, and he made it hail, and he made it all of the miracles that we can catalog. Rabbag says all of those miracles, he says, were b'shinoy teva hanimtzaot hashefelot. All those miracles were performed on lower order things in nature. Water, grass, inert things, right? Inert things. But if Joshua was able to make the sun stand still, then Joshua was able to perform a miracle on the highest order parts of nature. Okay? So what's the difference? So Moses did this kind of miracle, and Joshua did that kind of miracle. No, says Rabbag, remember, the closing verses of the Torah tell us, Lokam Naviot b'Yisrael k'moshe, that there never again arose a prophet in Israel equal to Moses. Asher yida'ol Hashem panim al panim. What made Moses unique? Two thoughts. But there's a second quality that was unique to Moses. L'chol ha'otot was also unique, the Torah tells us, in respect of the quality of miracles that he performed. Therefore, says Rabbag, it's very simple. Joshua could not have performed the miracle that he seems to have performed according to a literal reading of the text, because if that were so, it would be a miracle that was vastly greater than any of the miracles that performed by Moses, and that is axiomatically impossible. So, how do you explain the verse? He explains the verse as basically a figure of speech. And it's one that we can understand and that we can embrace because we have, an, if not identical, a very similar one. We talk about time as either being able to fly or to stand still. Well, we know very well that unless the there was a blackout and it's not getting electricity, the clocks don't stop, right? A clock cannot stop. Time cannot stand still, right? Neither, in fact, can time fly unless the clock's not programmed correctly. But we understand that when we say time flies, it means that we were able to accomplish something in less time than we anticipated. And if we say time stood still, we understand it to mean that it's taking us long. God's explanation of Ayidom HaShemesh V'Yarei HaChamad is the equivalent of time stood still. Meaning, ordinarily, the successful completion of the battle against Israel's enemies would have taken X amount of time.
Rabbi, if I can interrupt for a second. Sorry. Dr. Sokolow, can you hear me?
Was that they were angry and said, wow, we did all of that in such small amount of time. Yes?
Yeah, I'm saying your sound is not good. There's been for the last 5 minutes at least. I don't know what your sound freezes and choppy. I don't know if you're in a different place. I don't know. It could be the who knows what. But for some reason, your sound is going in and out a little bit. It's been that way for a few minutes.
It has done. I thought it was my reception.
Okay, so give me a second here.
I don't know if you have anything else on, turn it off. I don't know.
No. I don't see. Okay, let me see what is here.
I mean, we make out 96% of the words, you know, but so maybe it's the share screen, perhaps. I don't know if you want to talk without sharing the screen and people can look at their sources that we put in the, you know, on the chat box or in the website.
Okay, you're hearing me now?
We hear you most of the time, just every once in a while, the sound gets a little choppy. But why don't you speak and we'll see how it goes.
Connection.
I'm sorry?
I think it's a weak internet connection.
Yeah, so maybe there's something in the weather. Maybe the internet's down on the East Coast a little bit. These things do happen once in a blue moon. I mean, we haven't had this before, but why don't you speak and we'll make the best of it.
Okay. Anyway, so I was explaining that.
I'm standing still. Happening. Yes. Twice as fast as we expect.
Yeah, you're
yes.
Making time.
So, yes. So basically, Rabbag's explanation is that in looking back at this tremendous victory that was accomplished in less time than anticipated, they said, wow, it's as though time stood still. Or from their perspective, since I don't know whether they actually had the concept of time yet, certainly not as we calculated by seconds and minutes and hours, they said, it's as though the sun stood still. One more passage that I want to share with you from Ralbag, and it actually wasn't in the PowerPoint that I sent to Rabbi Kelman earlier. I decided at the last minute to throw it in. It has become not only my favorite passage from Ralbag, but it's become one of my all-time favorite passages in the history of Parshanot HaMikra. I just a couple of months ago published an article in the journal Megadim, a Tanakh journal that's published by Yeshivat HaRetzion. They put out for the first time a bilingual edition. And I wrote a piece for the English part of it. And the piece was called How, and in parentheses, Not to Teach the Akedah. And in this article, I cite this passage from the commentary of Ralbag to the 22nd chapter of Bereishit, to the story of Akedat Yitzchak, in which he says something that I wasn't aware of until about 6 months ago. I have been saying it for the better part of 40 years in teaching, but I had nothing more to cite as precedent than my own analysis. And then all of a sudden, this fell into my lap. Read it with me. It says that God tested Abraham. Rabbah points out, Nisa, hu me'inyan nisayon, that it is related to the notion of a test. V'inyan zeh ha'nisayon lefi da'ati. So according to Rabbah, what was the test to which God put Abraham? Sheba'atu ha'nivu'ah b'lashon misupak. The test was that God gave Abraham an ambiguous instruction. And the test was simply to see how would Abraham interpret his ambiguous instruction. The instruction was to take his son Yitzchak and to go to the land of Moriah, right? And to go up to a certain mountain. And then it's says, Ba'alehu sham le'ola. Both words. Ba'alehu, take him up, sham, there, on top of that mountain in the land of Moriah, le'ola, for the purpose of an ola sacrifice. And says Ralbag, that can be understood in two different ways. It could be understood either that Isaac was himself to be the ola, but there's another possible meaning, equally valid, says Ralbag, and that is that Isaac should be brought up to Abraham in offering a korban ola, in which case the purpose of Abraham taking Yitzchak to the top of the mountain was sheyitchanek yitchanech Yitzchak ba'avodat Hashem yitbarech. In order, as it were, to initiate Yitzchak into the proper way of worshiping God. Part of this that Rabbah does not address has to do with the question of how old Yitzchak was at this moment in time. And while the Agadah maintains that he was 37 years old, the Pshat is that he was a Na'ar, right? And that he was probably 13 years old. Maybe it was his bar mitzvah trip. God told Abraham to take Yitzchak with him and to go to a particular holy place, to a mountain in the land of Moriah, and there to teach Yitzchak how to bring a korban. But why was it ambiguous? It was ambiguous for the deliberate purpose of seeing whether at some point in time Abraham would misinterpret the instruction and give it the first interpretation rather than the second one. And as I elaborated on in that article, if we read the text carefully, we can find exactly the moment in time when this happens. When they first get to the Moriah country, what does Abraham say to his two servants who accompanied him? He says, "You remain here while Isaac and I go up the mountain. Vinishtaveh, do a perfectly ordinary worship service. Vinashuva aleichem, and we, the two of us, will return." It's when they get to the top of the mountain, what happens? Isaac says to Abraham, I'm getting this message again of unstable internet. Am I lost?
Yeah, no, I we hear most of it. You know what? I have no idea if this is the thing. By your name on the, on the participant, there's a little green button that I've never seen before. And I'm wondering if, I don't know what that is. You see next to your name, that's like,
I don't see it on my screen.
Okay. I don't know if we're getting
more. Maybe it means that I'm hosting.
No, you're co-hosting. That's the same as Zoid. But anyways, God gave an ambiguous command. He didn't mean for Yitzchak Avram to sacrifice his son. I'm just making sure I got what you're saying. He really meant it being an Olah. And that's what Avram thought. And that's why he said, Nishtachavim Nashuva Alechem. And now you're going to say, when switch? Somehow Yitzchak then said, I guess, Ayeh Hasela Olah. I'm assuming
right.
That.
Right. And Avram responds by saying that God that he understands implicitly in his instructions was that God would provide the korban. Now, did God provide the korban? Yes. The korban was already there because the isle that Abraham offers in lieu of his son didn't just show up there. It was there all the time. It was there, but Abraham failed to see it because it was achar on the other side, which means that if Avram, instead of taking Yitzchak, tying him up and placing him on the Mizbeach, had simply walked first to the far side of the hill, he would have found the aisle entwined in the Savach, and he would have offered them as the sacrifice, and I don't know whether the story would have ever made it into Tanakh. But in any event, as I said, that's the way that I've been teaching the story for the better part of 40 years or more, but it wasn't until recently that I actually saw that Ralbag had somehow anticipated it. With that in mind, and we do move on to Yosef ben Amir ben Yosef ben Yaakov ben Kasi, who, as I mentioned previously, comes from the province. Pardon?
Yeah, I'll suggest maybe if you don't share your screen, maybe that will help. Let's try it for a few minutes without screen share. Everybody can go on the website or see in the sources we published. I'll re-put them, the sources, so you can follow the sources along. I don't know if it'll help, but it might help, and I think that would be better if I can say so. So if you'll just unshare, I'll put it in again for everybody. We are getting most of it, but still it's, there you go. Okay.
Okay. Is that green dot still there?
No, it went away.
Okay, because what I did in the meantime is that there was something that showed up on my screen that said something about closed captioning.
Oh, I don't know. We have closed captioning. I don't know. Just talk. We'll see what happens.
And I X'd it. I crossed it out and the green dot went away.
Oh, okay. Well, so far, we hear you well. So.
Okay. All right. So you're asking me basically to open my own PowerPoint and to just simply go through it.
Right.
Sorry. Okay. So I have to go here and...
But while you do that, so basically the Rabbi is saying Avram failed the test of the Akedah.
No. The test was to see whether he would exceed his instructions. That's why, what does God say to him? God says to him, Ata yada'ati ki rei Elohim ata. Yeah, but, and of course, the big question that everybody asks is, what do you mean God says to him now, a moment before he didn't know? And the answer is, of course, God knew a moment before. But what wasn't in evidence a moment before was the extent to which Abraham was devoted that he would even but as I write in the article, what I think is the real moral of the story is that we dare not make our children the victims of our mistakes.
Okay, that's definitely not the issue. The sharing is definitely not the issue.
That if Abraham somehow was challenged by God, pardon?
I'm saying the sharing is not the issue. Maybe you want to switch. You want to switch computers, maybe?
Go back to sharing, please.
Your punchline there didn't come across.
The sharing's not the issue.
Bad exegesis.
I can't.
You're still co-host. You can share. Maybe if you go to your wife's computer, maybe it'll be better from there on the sound. I don't know. Sorry about this, everybody. This, you know, every 300 lectures this happens. Yeah, I don't know why, but. All right, Eric. Okay, somebody's recommending use a plug-in connection. That means not on a laptop.
It's not, they have a full.
Right. Okay, does anybody have like a grandchild around, like who can solve this problem? I think most of us are like, from the looking of, you know, we're not the crew that can solve these problems. But anyways, someone is pointing out, if you have not a laptop, if you have a desktop, I guess they call it, right, to plug it in, that's sometimes better. That is used to be true, I know. I don't know anymore if that's still true, but anyways, why don't we talk what's good? We have to pay greater attention. That's like, you know, the Chafetz Chaim didn't get a hearing gate. You know that story. We said that before. The Chafetz Chaim didn't get a hearing gate because he said that people have to yell for him to hear, and he's not. No one's going to yell Lashon Hara into his ear. So we have to pay attention a little bit more. We get 94% of the words, and we'll figure out the other 6%. Okay.
Okay. I'll tell you. I'll try. I'll try to. I can do the Ibn Kaspi. I mean, you know.
You can share your screen. I don't think that's the issue. If you want to share your screen, I don't think it was just as bad without the screen being shared as when it was. So.
I wonder if it has anything to do with the closed captioning, which is the first time I've seen it.
I doubt it. No, we've done closed captioning many, many, many times. So.
But not on this share. This share has.
Yeah, we did it last week. We did do it last week. I don't even know how to turn it off now, actually, the closed captioning, once it gets turned on. But we did do it last week and this year, too. So I don't think that's the issue. It could be the weather. It could be whatever. Okay, let's learn. Dr. Zuckerman, let's go. We'll listen carefully, even Kaspi.
Oh, must I?
Well.
Anyway, okay. So the punchline, in any case, was that that the lesson, the moral of the Akedah is that however laudatory it might be to exceed one's instructions, one should never make one's children the victim of misinterpretation. But in any event, okay. So I want to move now to Yosef ibn Kaspi, and basically it all pertains to one verse. You may remember that there was an incident reported in the wilderness in which Miriam and Aharon, Moses' sister and brother, spoke out against Moses on account of something to do with his marriage. Now, if you look carefully at the verse, it says that Miriam and Aharon spoke out against Moses alodot, on account of Haisha HaKushit Asher Lakach, on account of the Kushite woman he had taken. Taken is a euphemism for marriage, right? Ki Isha Kushit Lakach, because indeed Moses had taken, married a Kushite woman. If you look at the verse, there are two problems. One is a substantive problem, and the other is a literary problem. The substantive problem is that we know that Moses was married to a Midianite woman, right? Sipporah. So who's this Cushite woman? The literary problem is a redundancy. It says that Miriam and Aharon spoke out against Moses on account of his Cushite wife. And then it adds superfluously, because Moses had married a Cushite woman. Of course, if she was his wife, he married her. So the rabbinic interpretation of it, you see on the right-hand side of the screen, first in the Aramaic Targum of Onkelos, and then repeated in the commentary of Rashi, okay, which solves the literary problem by reading the verse a little differently from the way we read it. It reads it as follows. Umalelas Miriam v'Aharon b'Moshe. That's the same. Miriam and Aharon spoke out against Moses. Al Esek, that's alodot, on account of. Itisa shapirto dinisiv. So the first thing is that to solve the question of who was the Cushite woman, it says that Cushite shouldn't be written with a capital C. It should be written with a lowercase c, and it's a euphemism for a beautiful woman. Okay? Why would you call a beautiful woman a Cushite woman? We all know this from Yiddish, right? How do you get rid of an ayin hara? You say the opposite of what you mean. Okay? So since Cushite women apparently were not considered particularly beautiful, right? So a way in which to say that Moses was married to a beautiful woman and yet not to give her an ayin hara about it is to call her a Cushite woman. Okay. And it says, Are, because ititso shapirto dinesev, because the Cushite woman whom he had married, Rachek, he distanced her, or as you see Rashi's interpretation, he divorced her. So that solves both questions. The Cushite woman is the same Midianite woman, Tzipora, whom I knew he was married to, but she is euphemistically called a Cushite because she was beautiful. And the redundancy is not redundant because it's to be understood differently. It doesn't mean that he married her. I already knew that. Therefore, if it doesn't mean that he married her, and I already know that the verse is speaking in euphemisms, right? So what's a euphemistic way of saying divorce? A euphemism for divorce is to say he married her. He married her twice. Okay. This is, as I said, the standard, the conventional rabbinic understanding of this text. Ibn Kaspi comes along, and very much in the tradition that we saw in Ralbag and previously in Radak, says, I am amazed that my predecessors, and he says, all of them are more perfect than I am. I barely rise to the height of the soles of their feet. Right? So with all this expression of humility, he says, how could they ever have imagined explaining something in the Torah in a manner that is the antithesis of the text? The text says, Isha Kushit Lakach, he married a Cushite woman, and you're telling me that I'm supposed to understand it, that he divorced her? That's the opposite of what's written in the text. And he says at the end, the same as we saw Radak previously. And if in fact this were the real intent of the Torah, if indeed it really wanted us to understand that he had divorced her, why didn't it just say so? Why of all things did it use the opposite? Now he goes a little further. And he schreis gewalt. That's an old Provençal expression. Okay? He schreis gewalt against onkelos, right? For having translated that way. The sages of the Talmud for having accepted that translation. And horror of horrors, Ibn Ezra, right? He doesn't understand how could they all have concurred in this interpretation, which requires you to read into the text something that is the antithesis of what it says. And he goes further and he says, Hayikare perush hamarat milot hefech behefech. Is the use, the substitution of antonyms constitute interpretation? He says interpretation is interpreting words literally as they are understood conventionally. For example, he says, the Torah says, lo tava'aru esh, right? You're not allowed to kindle a fire on Shabbat. It says, lo tochlu al hadam, that you're not allowed to eat blood, okay? Now, the rabbinic interpretations of those verses take the words literally, right? To do otherwise, he says, is not interpretation. It's substitution, contradiction, erasure, uprooting, tearing down. And he says, and if this is a legitimate interpretive method, he says, hey, I got a good one for you. It says, God says of his relationship to the Jewish people, he uses the same word, lakach. It says, etchem lakach Hashem. God took you to be his chosen people. If you're telling me now that it's perfectly legitimate to interpret the word lakach as to divorce, as to put it at distance, then maybe I'm supposed to understand the verse to mean that God rejected us. Or if it says, v'lakach hu ushcheino, when it's describing the laws of the Korban Pesach, and it says that if you can't afford a whole Korban Pesach on your own, then you should share one with your neighbor. And it says, v'lakach hu ushcheino, you and your neighbor together should take the Korban Pesach. Once again, if you're telling me now that to take can mean to reject, then why shouldn't I interpret this to mean that you should together discard the Korban Pesach? Chai Hashem, as God lives, he takes an oath and he says, as sublime as this approach may be, right, coming as it does with the recommendation of the sages of the Talmud and with Onkelos and Ibn Ezra, he says, lo uchala, he says, for me, he says, it's too much for me. However, he says, God forbid that I should do something like this. I can either abandon the Torah of Moshe entirely and believe, God forbid, in a new Torah already in existence, or do these others have done, God forbid. Meaning, he finds himself on the horns of a dilemma. To follow the rabbis in their interpretation, he says, he simply cannot do it. So what interpretation does he say? Very simple, he says. He says that the explanation of that which is written here, according to what he calls Be'ur Hechrechi Milashon Ha'ivri, the necessary meaning of the Hebrew language, is, and this is the part that's highlighted, a Cushite woman is not a euphemism for a beautiful woman, not a euphemism for Moses' wife who was a Midianite. A Cushite woman is Isha Me'eretz Cush. It is a woman who comes from the land of Cush. And ki isha kushit lakach means that Moses married a woman from the land of Cush. Now, what does it mean? It means, he says, very simple. I don't know if you can see the top of the screen. He says that, can you see the top of the screen? I can't. But anyway, he says that very simply, he says, we know that the Torah does not necessarily narrate to us every single thing that was done by every person mentioned in the Torah during every day of their life. Therefore, I know from Sefer Shmot that Moses married a Midianite woman named Zipporah. The fact that the Torah nowhere comes right out and tells me that Moses also married a woman from the land of Cush doesn't mean that it's impossible. Therefore, he says that what were Miriam and Aharon complaining about? They weren't complaining about the relationship that Moses had with his Midianite wife, Zipporah. They were complaining about the relationship that Moses had with his anonymous Cushite wife. That sometime after Moses married Zipporah, he took a Cushite woman as his second wife, for whatever reason he had. It's not for us to question his actions, because they were certainly motivated by wisdom. And we don't know exactly when this marriage occurred, whether it was at this moment in their travels or whether it occurred previously, because like many things in the Torah, it's simply not recorded. Okay. Because there is no other record of this activity, however, and lest we become bewildered over the reference to a Cushite woman when there is no previous reference to it. Now he's going to address the literary problem. He says, why? He says, yes, the Torah is redundant. But it's redundant for a purpose. Because if it had only said that they complained about Hayisha HaKushit Asher Lakach, I'd spend the rest of the day scratching my head and saying, Moses married a Cushite woman. Where in the world did that come from? Therefore, the Torah says, yeah. Kisha kushit lakach. Even though there is no explicit description of this marriage, it took place. So don't worry about it. Don't aggravate yourself over it. Okay. I don't think I should press my luck. I will hold here and we'll get to Ramban on another occasion. So let me pause here, and I hope that most of these 31 chats just simply say, I don't hear you.
A lot of them, but thank God the last 15 minutes were perfect. The last,
Yeah, so it could be that whatever that thing was with the closed captioning was screwing it up.
I don't know, but it's still going on. But okay, anyways, let's go through the questions, and then I have to discuss about the Akeda, why, whatever. We'll come back to that.
Oh, good. Okay. Radat did not write a book or a guide on biblical essay. He wrote a commentary. Radat did write other books. He wrote a book on biblical Hebrew grammar called the Michlol, and he wrote a biblical Hebrew dictionary called Sefer HaShorashim. He also wrote a manual for scribes called Eight Sofer, but he didn't actually write a guide for biblical exegesis. He just wrote a commentary. In that commentary, here and there, he does, on occasion, like Ibn Ezra before him, actually describe his methodology. The Netziv wrote that Moses did not walk to the top of Sinai, but was carried by the cloud. Don't know what this has to do with anything. Could this inspire, describing him? I doubt it very much. He was very clear to him what was bothering him. And if this were it, he probably would have mentioned it. Yeah, sound issues.
Gershon's question. That's the next one. 8:33 p.m.
Alehu Sham La'ola. Rabbah can be interpreted as explaining, call Isaac up for an aliyah. No. I've never heard Alehu Sham La'ola to call him up for the Torah reading. That's a nice vort, but I don't think there is any support for it in the text. Rabbi, you might as well go ahead.
Yeah, I would just, when I said, according to Rabbi, he failed the test of the academy, and I know that's harsh language, but according to the Rabbag, it's possible he's supposed to just do a korban and not sacrifice Yitzchak. So why is that good that he's sacrificing Yitzchak?
No, it's not good. That's why God stopped him.
I understand, but that means he's failing. He misunderstood.
No. Again.
According to this, I'm playing here, trying to understand, take the Rabbag at face value. Well, why not? God gave him because he wants to see how smart is Avram. Can Avram figure out? Avram should know that God would never demand human sacrifices. That's the traditional way to understand the Akedah is Avram knows human sacrifices. His whole life is teaching human sacrifices wrong. And then God says to him, do the opposite of what you believe in. That's the classic understanding. And that's a tremendous test. How can Avram go against his whole life? Besides giving up his kid, it's his whole philosophy of life. That's a test. But now the Rabbag is saying that's not true. The Rabbag is saying he really could have understood it to mean that just bring a korban. So that's a mistake of Abraham to think to sacrifice his son. No, that's what I would say.
Absolutely. Right. As I said, the lesson.
So that's why he failed. He failed in that. I know that's why you can't say that.
No. I'm delighted when we're done. I will send you a PDF of the article. My point of departure in the article was education. I never have and do not see any value in presenting an image especially to children in third or fourth grade who are learning the Akedah. I never saw the value in presenting to them an image of a father, not just of a father, who would even erroneously consider his child to be a reasonable sacrifice to God. And I certainly never understood what's the value in portraying God as somebody who, even if he never wanted that to happen, allowed Abraham to go for 3 days imagining that that's what he was going to do. So my point of departure was to simply find a balance for the conventional interpretation of the story so that it would spare religious education the need in which to turn Avraham into a pretzel and God into something worse. There's a lot of it that has to do with the ataya da'ati. There's a lot of it that has to do with the interpretation of the word nisa. In a nutshell, my preferred translation of nisa is that God proved Abraham. Because like the word nisa, the word prove in English means both the process and its result. Okay? Unlike test is only the process, but proof is both the process and the result. That is consistent with the interpretation that's offered by Saadia, by Ibn Ezra, by Yosef Albo in the Sefer Ikarim, and by others of Nisa as not being to test, but to demonstrate. To demonstrate in the sense of to publicize the result of the test. That the Akedah was a setup, and the purpose of the setup was to give Abraham an opportunity to show the lengths to which he might be prepared to go if indeed that's what God desired of him.
But why did God have to make it ambiguous? Well, then just make it clear. And then at the last minute, that way we always understood that God said, go sacrifice him. He doesn't make it ambiguous for that.
The ambiguity is theological. Not anthropomorphic. The ambiguity is not to save Avraham's reputation. The ambiguity is to save God's reputation. Because God is the one who prohibits child sacrifice in the Torah. God is the one who has the prophet Yirmiyahu on 3 separate occasions speak out against child sacrifice. which the Gemara in Tanis and elsewhere interprets as, and this is the title of the article, it says, Lo Allah bida'ati. God says, it never, ever even occurred to me that Abraham should sacrifice his son. So if it never occurred to God that Abraham should sacrifice his son, how could he have told him to do it? So it isn't so much Abraham, it's God who needs to be rescued.
I don't know, that doesn't work for me.
Rabag's interpretation rescues God.
Not really. God's like pulling a fast one, you know. So in case I get accused in court of being a cruel God, I'll say that's not what I meant. That's not God doesn't act that way. God's, you know, a straight shooter. Like, I didn't say, so I'll say it in a way so Avram can misunderstand me, and then I'll show how great he is, but I didn't really mean it, and nobody should think I meant it. Well, Avram thought he meant it.
I'm sure by now Ralbag has been able to ask God whether he in fact was intentionally ambiguous or unintentionally ambiguous. But really? I haven't gotten there yet.
I've often written, and including in my next Afyomi piece that I'm almost finished, I've often written the Torah is purposely ambiguous because the Torah wants us to understand things in many ways. But by the Akedah, that's one place where I wouldn't say that. In other words, it's all over the place the Torah is ambiguous because the Torah is multiple messaging. But by the, in other words, if it's ambiguous, then right, Avram misunderstood, in which case that's a little bit of a, I mean, that's, you know, the modern people, you know, there's sort of the modern interpretation that maybe Avram failed the test of the Akedah because God never told him to sacrifice. And they're without knowing it, I'm sure they're taking Rabag and they're just putting it in very modern terms and saying, you know, God didn't say that and God didn't mean that. And Avram misunderstood it and God had to correct his misunderstanding. You know, that's a more, you leave out the stuff that God wanted Avram to misunderstand him. No, God wanted him never. In other words, it makes more sense. God never wanted him to sacrifice his son. Avram totally misunderstood the commandment. And then at the last minute, no, Avram, no, I never told you. I didn't tell you to sacrifice. That's a much more clear explanation. What people today would call heresy. You know, somebody says that he's an apikoros. But that's much straighter than the Rabag's pshat. Anyways, I'll let other people talk. I don't want to.
Could you say something about why, if there were these two alternatives, Jewish tradition chose the one in which God ordered him to kill his son?
So that's a very long footnote, but it's not a chiddush of my own. It's the subject of a book by Shalom Spiegel called The Last Trial. It's because during the First Crusade, the recorded instances of Jewish parents martyring themselves and their families found its expression in Piyut. Listen, if you open a Slichos book, right, a well-edited Slichos book, look up Akedah. Right, every day's slichos, right, for the whole month of Elul through Yom Kippur, every day's slichos has a piyut about the Akedah. Mm-hmm. And almost without fail, those piyutim come from France and Germany during the very end of the 11th and the 12th century, and they were inspired, if one can use the word inspiration in this context, inspired by these acts of martyrdom. And that basically became the conventional understanding. Not that there aren't passages in earlier Talmudic and Midrashic literature that take it that way, but that in and of itself would not necessarily have forced the issue. But that's just one possibility.
You should know that the closed captioning is doing Akedah as Akedah. So that's fun.
If you Google Avi Dolgin, you will find a wonderful retelling of the Akedah from the point of view of Yitzchak.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's, I mean, that also depends a lot how old he was, you know, the whole thing. Gil Pearl spoke a little bit about that on the art, you know, what did Yitzchak go willingly to the Akedah or did he fight? So, you know, that's not 1,000% clear. We generally perceive he went along, but, Dr. Sokol, you want to add something to that?
No, I actually once heard, Uriel Simon, manage actually to identify as the pshat of the Akedah that he was only 13 years old. Well, certainly not 37. Nobody can tell whether it was 12, 13, or 14. But he said, for example, when Yitzchak says, Hinei ha'esh v'ha'etzim v'ayei ha'sela olah. Now, if Yitzchak is cataloging all of the things that Avraham brought along that are, you know, that are necessary for a korban, he left one out. He left out the ma'achelet. And Simon suggested that he left out the ma'achelet the way you'd expect a child to leave out the ma'achelet because it was simply too frightening to mention. It's also a question about, you know, not that this is absolutely so either way, but you finally get to the point that you have to decide whether you have a 137-year-old Avraham lifting a 37-year-old Yitzchak bodily and placing him on top of the Mizbeach, or whether it's only a 113-year-old Avraham lifting up a 13-year-old Yitzchak. As I said, that can go either way, but, you know, every little bit helps.
That's where the Torah is ambiguous on purpose, I think, because the Torah wants us to read the story of the Akedah as Yitzchak as a 4-year-old, as a 13-year-old, as an 18-year-old, and as a 37-year-old, whatever. I think that's on purpose, because you read the Akedah very different, and that the Torah is ambiguous. But what God told Avram to do shouldn't be ambiguous. Like, I think they're all bug. It just, whatever. It's, you know... Listen, I mean, you just did a piece here. You know, these Mefarshim today, if you brought them into Yeshiva, they'd burn their books. I mean, they're, you know, the quote unquote heresy, modern day heresy that they all have, the Pashtanim is, you know, their approach, whatever, it's not the common approach today.
Well, I understand that, and that's why
I'm not saying that's good. I'm just saying that's the reality. I think it's very important that people be aware that in our history we have Pashtanim, who took on Chazal, who did all kinds of things that today would be considered "quote unquote," you know, unorthodox.
So that's why I'm presently completing the last revision of a book called Pursuing Peshat.
Okay, good. All right, you'll let us know when it's ready. Okay, I think we can let people go. I apologize for the little bit of sound, but you've just had to pay attention more. And we got, I think, 98%. Maybe a little ambiguous. Maybe we didn't hear everything you said, so we can have a machlok at what you said. That ties into the shir perfectly. Okay, tomorrow morning, Malkus Simchowitz, Part 2, Jews of Ancient Egypt, 10:30 a.m., 12 p.m., 12 noon. Shuli Mishkin on the archaeology. I think we're on Shoftim. Tomorrow evening, 8:30, no one notice from Princeton University. We're getting the younger crowd, giving the Parsha Shir tomorrow night. And then Friday morning, my Shir on the Siddur, 9 a.m. Next week, we have three new series starting. They are all now on the website. They weren't this more afternoon, but they are Tuesday. Aaron Kohler, Professor Aaron Kohler of Yeshiva University, whom Moshe Sokol, I'm sure, knows quite well, will be giving a 6-part series on Megillat Esther. That's Tuesday at 9:30 a.m. And then Wednesday at 11 a.m., Menachem Kellner, I'm sure you also know well, will be giving the Rambam, the difference between Rabbi Yehuda Levi and the Rambam. Rabbi Yehuda Levi and the Rambam, and their different attitudes towards non-Jews, etc. Shalom Elohim. I'm sorry?
There are different attitudes towards everything.
Right, there are different attitudes towards everything. That's correct. Rabbi Yehuda Levi and the Rambam, that's it. We have a pluralistic tradition, what can I tell you? And then at 2 o'clock, something a little bit different. We'll see. We're going to start with the 5-week series. Mark Shapiro is going to interview some of the locals of our trips that, please God, we'll be able to resume this summer. But people have been on trips, haven't, so virtual tours, and we're going to be talking to the locals. We're going to start with Rafi in Morocco. He is quite a character. If you have anybody who's been to Morocco, and if, I know a few of you here have been with us to Morocco. So Rafi will be talking to Mark. He'll be interviewing him about the life in Morocco. That'll be this Wednesday at 2 p.m. Okay? And all our regular shurim. Anyways, everybody be well. Laila Tov, invite a friend, and we look forward to seeing you in the near future. And thank you for your patience. And okay, and thank you for your comments. There, Dr. Aaron Kohler, who's going to start next week. He wrote a book on Megillat Esther. That's right. His more recent, he wrote a book on Esther a few years ago, and then he wrote a recent book on the Akedah. Thank you, Chaim. Okay, for that. Okay. All right. Any other comments, criticisms, suggestions? Makasha. Got quiet. Okay.
I love the comment on how to teach it to third and fourth graders. I've always found it very, very disturbing when it's taught to third and fourth graders.
Debbie, if you send me an email, I'll send you a copy of the article.
Yeah, if you send it to me.
Sent it to you.
Oh, you send me. So I can post it next week. I'll send that when we send. I can do it now. I can send all the people who registered for the class. If people are like, I'll just send an email. Anybody who's registered.
I would
registered.
Love to see it.
Or you can ask me for it. You can ask me. Maybe that's easier. Ask me. I'll send it to you. Or if I can just send an email to everybody and whoever
I
wants
to. I would love a copy. Great. Thank you.
Okay. But okay, I have to figure that out. I don't know if to send it is complicated. It means I have to post it on our website. Okay. We can do that. That'll probably take a couple of days. But if you really want it soon, I'll just forward it to you.
Jay?
Send me an email. Yes.
We in Shalom in school, we learned in second grade. Then after when Hadassah went to Shalom, they moved it to third grade. But we learned Chumash in second grade.
Right. But no, the question is, when do you learn the Akkadian? How did they teach the Akkadian?
They start with Bereishis.
They skip the first 11 chapters normally. No, they start with Abraham.
They didn't, but when we were second grade, we really didn't grasp the whole situation anyway.
Right. The old minhag is to start teaching Vayikra. I also wrote an article on that. Right. That's an easier book to teach, really. Yeah. To teach kids by Bereishit, boy, the moral ambiguity.
That was rarely, if ever, honored in practice.
Right, but you understand any other book you teach, you're raising tremendous problems. Bereishit, it's all. I mean, everybody, the moral complexity and the even of our avod and imahot, the things that on the surface appear very wrong and maybe below the surface were wrong. You know, you expose them to that. You teach Bamidbar, it's one complaint after another. Shmot, one complaint after another. The only book where you sort of avoid the moral complexities. Or Vayikra, but then the kids say, who needs sacrifices today? So there's no book in the Chumash you can teach without a sophisticated moral sense. What can I tell you? You have to, the Chumash is for mature people. I don't know what to say.
Jay, you tried to make, you know, Pshat people would find it epicurious. And Moshe, you just mentioned it's a book you're working on. Hasn't it, though, in the last 30 years been just a greater return to Pshat within the from. I mean, I don't know how much of that is the effect of the Gush.
So it's actually a chapter in the that about 2 years and examined role of Tanakh in Jewish education.
That we didn't hear. That your sound went off. But Michael, that's for sure true. I think there has been a return to Pshat. I think. Maybe people who know better can correct me. I think this is a big divide between the modern Orthodox world and the Haredi world. The Haredi world rushes pshat. I mean, you can't read Chumash like you read Chumash without. I once had somebody. I'm not going to mention his name. People would know him, I think. And boy, we got into a discussion once, and I was like blown away. And this is someone who's not really in the Haredi world. He's more sort of in the. I mean, he's. You would call him right-wing modern Orthodox. And he basically, you know, I wrote an article, one of my Divrei Torah, and I quote what Rashi said, and I wrote why Rashi's difficult, and I gave an alternate explanation. So he said, that's like epicursis. How can you quote Rashi and disagree with Rashi? Like, who are you? I said, I don't know. What do you mean? I'm explaining there's a difficulty. Doesn't mean that's who said, no, he was taught, you know, he'd sit there for a year to solve the problem. You can't quote Rashi and disagree with Rashi. In the yeshiva world, they don't, Pshat is non-existent. They don't believe him, Pshat. I think, am I wrong? I don't know.
They also take Midrashim as Pshat.
Yes, they follow the Rambam's definition of, oh, I don't want to say, but yes, correct. They take Midrashim as Pshat. I don't know. The Rambam considers that terrible. And that's an understatement. You know, I don't want to say what the Rambam says because I don't want to insult people. But yeah, I don't know. It's a big problem.
You know, it's not at all a coincidence that the introduction in every published edition of the Ein Yaakov is the Ma'amar al Drashot Chazal of Avraham ben Harambam. And that's okay. Another classic example of an introduction that rarely gets read.
I'm not familiar with that introduction. I'll take a look now, my Ein Yaakov, okay? Now, I mean, I if you say Rav Avraham ben Harambam, so I know it's rationalistic and it's anti-literal and, you know, Midrashim, of course, but I haven't actually read it. So I have to, there's so much stuff that people, you know, what we teach in the yeshiva canon is the Talmud Bavli is 5% of our tradition. I mean, as great as the Talmud Bavli, and it's the most important work. Talmud Bavli is the most important work we have, more important than the Chumash. But it's not our whole tradition. That's it's a slice of our tradition, Talmud Bavli. You learn Daf Yomi, you don't even learn half of Shas because you miss, there are only 37 Masechtot that have Gemara on it. You don't learn Adias, you don't learn Pirkei Avos, you don't learn Shkah, you don't learn all these Masechtot, you don't learn Taurus, Kodesh, and nothing anyways. All right. We'll let people go. I'm why are people still here? I thought the class ended 20 minutes ago.
This is the most
fun part. I know. All right. Anybody else? Comments? So I shouldn't have the last word. That's not fair. You know, I cheat. I thought I can cut, you know, so anybody else is welcome to have the last word.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Oh, that's a good thing.
Okay. It should be a Kodesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov, that's right. Misha Nichnas Adar. I forgot to mention Rosh Chodesh. Yes, and we can be machmir to say Misha Nichnas Adar, Marvim Simcha, and Adar Aleph too. I think we should all be machmir. Tov Lev Mishta Tamid, as the Shulchan Aruch concludes Or HaChaim. So, okay. Laila Tov, everybody. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank you. Good night.